May it please the court, good morning. I'm Stephen Jackson and I represent I represent Kim in Toronto in this Social Security case.
It isn't bad enough that you have to argue. You have to argue worrying about fires.
It's an unusual situation.
Yeah. So it was hard to see the forest for the trees. So could you try to summarize in some way that would cut through all the
yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Gibberish and explain what her problem is.
I've never seen so many doctors in one case either. There are more doctors here than.
Well, certainly.
And some very good ones, I might add.
Certainly over an extensive two-year period, she's seen a number of physicians, neurosurgeons.
She's become an addict also.
I think that's an open question. But the crux of this case is really about the residual functional capacity assessment that was reached here by the administrative law judge. Ms. Indoronto testified credibly throughout the hearing about all of her different complaints of pain and how it affected her daily activities. And there's substantial evidence in the record from these various physicians about multiple disc herniations. She had two herniated discs in her cervix. She had another one in her thoracic.
Half the population is walking around with herniated discs. I don't know that that gets anywhere.
I think
I read recently 70% of Americans have had back problems. So you've got a.
Yeah, but how many are bad enough to be operated on? I think that might be.
I think those issues are important issues, but the more significant impairment that she has here is this Arnold-Chiari malformation, which is a congenital defect, whereas the degenerative discs are degenerative. They're over time.
This ailment with the cerebellum poking into the spinal cord is very horrible to read about, but what are the actual consequences?
Make you feel better to know that no matter what happens in this case, we're all going to live.
And that the elevators are working.
Let the record show.
I'm sorry, sir. Could you repeat your question?
Yes, this ailment with this cerebellum poking into the spinal cord, I say it sounds very horrible, but what are the actual consequences?
Well, apparently
she was.
All right, let me try to regroup here. The typical kind of symptoms that we see in the literature, and we noted that in footnote 4 of our reply brief, the kind of things that one will see in an individual who suffers from their Arnold-Chiari malformation are headaches and blurred vision. And that's really the crux of our case here, Your Honor, is that the ALJ did not accommodate those in reaching his residual functional capacity assessment of Ms. Indoronto.
In other words, would you would want to remand to
yes.
really find out what jobs there are for people with this kind of blurred vision and
yes.
horrendous headache?
Absolutely. She testified repeatedly throughout her session with the administrative law judge about how her daily activities were affected, in particular by the headaches, which were almost always accompanied by the blurred vision. For instance, she said, I believe it, that in the record at page 43, that when she got the headaches, she had to stop reading. So here's an individual who is having these reasonable symptoms from.
Well, but wait. Now, the administrative law judge said that her complaints are not fully credible.
He did, but the only complaints that he rejected as being not fully credible were her allegations that she needed to lie down and to take hot baths. But if we put that aside, he doesn't challenge anything else that she had said. He hasn't challenged any of her other credibility regarding her activities of daily living or how she's been affected by these multiple symptoms and conditions that she suffers from. But here, without accommodating for those headaches, and in particular without accommodating for that blurred vision, leaping to the conclusion, as the ALJ has done here, that she would be capable of performing sedentary work with low concentration, the dots are simply not connected because there's no substantiation here in his decision, in his reaching that conclusion about how he gets there. I mean, she talks repeatedly about the pain, about the headaches, and about the blurred vision, but it's not reflected in the RFC. And without giving that proper RFC to the vocational expert, it just doesn't make sense that he could reach a conclusion that she would be capable of performing as a cashier or as a mechanical assembler or as a packager. Certainly someone who, in their normal life at home, who she's already not working and her life is interrupted, her day is interrupted with headaches and blurred vision, she wouldn't be able to stay on task as a cashier. I can't imagine her being able to make change or being able to assemble goods if she has blurred visions. And certainly if they're accompanied by headaches that she has testified could last anywhere from a few minutes to several hours, it's going to interrupt her.
Medical evidence seems to be heavily focused on her back, not on this condition that you mentioned.
It's heavily focused on the herniated disc, but
right.
Dr. Sobolski, who did treat her for the cervical herniation and actually performed one of the surgeries.
I mean, aren't you really shifting the focus? At the hearing, the focus was on her back. Now you're shifting it to the to the headaches and the blurred vision.
Well, they were also a part of the questioning and the testimony at the hearing. There was several questions asked by the administrative law judge about this condition, about the Arnold Chiari malformation, and she said, yes, I get headaches from it, I get blurred vision, they interrupt what I'm doing, I can't read. She is no, the combination prevents her from even sitting and doing something as simple as watching a full television program. But this isn't reflected in the RFC assessment. And again, the ALJ has not made a logical and accurate bridge from this testimony, which he apparently finds fully credible, to an assessment that she can perform, these very simple, unskilled jobs that would require someone to remain on task. And she's going to be interrupted, especially by the headaches and by the blurred vision. Unimaginable that she would be able to continue to function in a competitive environment where she would be expected to stay on task and take scheduled breaks. And yet, she's told us that a headache could last a few minutes or an hour or an entire day.
How much are you relying on the evidence that you submitted when you asked for reconsideration?
I think we're relying quite heavily on that because...
That's problematic because we decide that the agency was not required to grant that reconsideration, and we're just limited to the record that was before the administrative law judge. There's very little there about the headache and blurred vision.
Well, actually, prior, if you look at the record, I believe it's at 266, Dr. Sobolski mentioned that her Arnold Chiari malformation has become symptomatic, and he writes next to it, i.e. blurred vision. He's noted that she's got the blurred vision. She's told several treating physicians that she has the headaches. One of the state agency doctors...
A lot of people have headaches and blurred vision. Depends how serious the problem is. And my impression was that there really was very little evidence about the gravity of that condition, that the focus, as I say, was on the back.
There seems to be an emphasis here from her case manager, this began as a workers' compensation claim, and the treatment seems that it has been directed by the insurance carrier, and there is a lot of focus on the herniated discs. But she complains initially after the auto accident that she was involved in, when she was rear-ended at about 35 miles an hour, of headaches, and they appear later in the record. Dr. Sobolski notes them, and even Dr. Otaluga notes them, and he's the state agency doctor that also conducted an exam. And there's an underlying basis for those headaches and for the blurred vision, and that's the
malformation. Is there any medical evidence about her blurred vision? Was she given eye tests?
The government, argues that there were no objective tests of vision loss, but she never claimed that she had lost vision. She's always claimed.
Well, I never look. If your vision is blurred, you're going to have trouble with an eye chart, aren't you?
But that's assuming that at the moment that she's having that test, when she's in that doctor's office, that she's having a headache with the blurred vision. But with the underlying condition under...
Well, but this becomes a little mysterious, right? I mean, you're saying she has symptoms which are sort of by definition unobservable?
No, the symptoms are reasonably expected with the condition that she suffers from, the Arnold Chiari malformation. And
I don't actually think you have evidence of that.
She reported.
But you don't have medical evidence. The doctor says, yes, look at this condition. I looked at her back of her head, and I would expect her to have severe headaches and blurred vision, severe blurred vision from what I've seen. You don't have that, do you?
But there's no...
You don't.
There's no objective test. No, we don't. There's no objective test for headache.
Mm-hmm.
But under 404.1529, she doesn't have to prove that she has...
No, but of course that's true for pain generally. But you claim she has a very specific problem, this malformation in the back of her head. Well, you think, if you attribute symptoms to a very specific problem, you ought to be able to find a doctor who will testify, look, given this malformation and how it was affected by the automobile accident, I would expect her to have disabling headaches and blurred vision. And there isn't any of that evidence.
The evidence that's there is largely testimony and the records from her doctors who have recorded her complaints of headaches and blurred vision. Again, under 404.1529, that's enough.
Why don't you find a neurologist to testify about her condition, about this condition, what it does to people?
Well, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, but we didn't handle the case below, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying it's your fault, but the fact is you don't have neurological evidence.
But we do have neurological evidence of the underlying condition, and that's the Arnold Chiari malformation. And it did appear on the MRIs, and Dr. Malik noted that initially after
That's true, but you don't have evidence which connects the specific condition revealed by the MRI with her symptoms and says, yes, if you have this kind of MRI picture, then yes, you're likely to have really bad headaches and blurred vision, so you couldn't be a cashier. I don't see that here.
But here, she has credibly testified that she has the headache. She has the underlying medical condition that could reasonably lead to those headaches. She has doctors who have understood that condition. Dr. Cebulski makes the comment that condition has become symptomatic with the blurred vision. That's the evidence that we have that points to the fact that the headaches and the blurred vision are a part and parcel of her, entire sum of complaints here that have prevented her from returning to work.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank
Ms.
you.
Ms. Ahmed?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Mona Ahmed for the Commissioner of Social Security. I think it's very important to keep in mind in this case that this was not a case where the ALJ completely ignored a claimant's testimony about her limitations. This was a case where the ALJ gave the claimant, he accepted most of what she said about how her impairments affected her.
Forgive me, but I think we should really zero in on this because I'm well aware that the ALJ mentioned the vision and headache symptoms, but where is that present in his decision? In other words, where does he take, you know, where does he consider that impairment? Because if she's prone to headaches and blurred vision, her work options are really severely limited, and the idea that someone like that could work, for instance, as a cashier, is almost ludicrous. Imagine she'd be giving out, you know, 20s for one. God, heaven only knows what she'd be doing there.
Well, the ALJ, I can't point to a specific passage of the ALJ's decision where he discussed the headaches in any kind of detail, but I think it's very important to keep in mind what Ms. Indoranto testified about her headaches, because she did not testify that these headaches were so incapacitating that she was unable to do anything during the day. What she said was that she did have headaches. They usually occurred on a daily basis. They lasted sometimes an hour, sometimes a few hours, but she took medication for them, and the medication made her headaches tolerable. That's at page 41 of the record.
Yeah, but it seems to have made her an addict also.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
If you take enough of these medications, your headaches will go away, but you become an addict.
Well, there was not evidence Ms. Indoranto's apparent addiction and overuse of narcotic medications. That was not in the evidence that was presented to the ALJ.
I mean, at least one of the doctors has the report state that she's become, I mean, they were sending her to, you know, places where you deal with, you know.
Her physician was concerned about her use of narcotic medication.
Yeah.
Her physician, however, there's two points to make about that evidence. First of all, that evidence was never submitted to the administrative law judge. That evidence was submitted for the first time to the appeals council. This court has made very clear on numerous occasions, and the cases are cited in the brief, the commissioner's brief, that evidence that is submitted to the appeals council cannot be considered as a basis for finding the ALJ's decision deficient. We can't blame the ALJ for not considering evidence that Ms. Indoranto chose not to give him. So, and in fact, you know, she when she testified at the hearing, there was nothing in her testimony to suggest that she had a problem with abusing prescription medication.
Well, what about the blurred vision? I mean, it's a puzzle. Did anyone ask her at the hearing, you know, what do you mean exactly by blurred vision? Do you mean, you know, you can't read at times because your eyes cross or something like that?
Well, Ms. Indoranto did not really testify in any significant detail about the precise nature of her blurred vision. What she did testify about was that her activities were very limited because of her back and her neck pain. Again, that was the impairment that was really emphasized at the time of the hearing.
She really has a lot of problems, doesn't she? I mean, she has a lot of problems.
Well, what the ALJ found based on the medical evidence was that, yes, she has some herniated discs in her back. She did undergo surgical treatment for the herniated discs. But that doesn't mean that a person can't do sedentary work. And this medical record shows that no single physician suggested that she couldn't do sedentary work. There's no physician that said, because of this Arnold Chiari malformation, that she would be unable, that she would have headaches that were so severe and incapacitating.
Did any physician comment on her headaches and blurred vision? Reach any medical conclusion about them?
No, the physicians documented her complaints. Some of the physicians did, not all of them, because sometimes she didn't complain of headaches and blurred vision when she went to see physicians.
No, is there anything beyond noting her complaint?
Noting her complaint. The only conclusion is it's basically a very brief handwritten note. It's on page 266 as counsel for Ms. Indorato pointed out. That was Dr. Cebulski. It was a handwritten note where he, under his heading for impression, he wrote Arnold Chiari malformation, symptomatic, i.e. blurred vision. One piece of evidence in the entire record.
Of course, but that's by the neurosurgeon.
That's true, but there's nothing from him that suggests the extent to which she had blurred vision or how it would affect her ability to perform work activities. And so based on that record, and there's very, very little evidence in this record. This wasn't a case where the ALJ simply ignored an entire line of evidence.
What about Dr. Fisher, who said, presently Mrs. Indorato's prognosis is poor, predicated from the worsening of her subjective complaints of headaches, blurred vision, pain in her extremities.
Dr. Fisher's evaluation report was not submitted to the ALJ. In fact, Dr. Fisher's report is dated several months after the date of the ALJ's decision. It's dated in December of 2000. The ALJ issued a decision in September of 2000. So again, that evidence can't be used as a basis for saying that the ALJ erred. Ms. Indorato chose not to give the ALJ that evidence. The evidence that the ALJ saw showed that this Arnold Chiari malformation was not a subject of clinical concern to her physicians. It was something that they wanted to monitor. They wanted to watch it. Nobody said, no doctor said this would prevent her from working. And her own testimony didn't really suggest that it would prevent her from working. She didn't say that her vision was so blurred that she stumbled around all of the time and couldn't stand up. She continued to drive, notwithstanding her blurred vision.
Well, why would it be harmful to, let's say, remand so that the ALJ would have the opportunity to consider all the impairments and to explain whether or not he took the blurred vision or headaches into consideration, which he hasn't done?
Well, based on the evidence that was presented to the ALJ, he did consider all of her impairments, and his RFC finding accounts for all of those impairments that are supported in the evidence that was submitted to him.
But what you're doing is you're faulting her physician for doing the same thing that the ALJ did.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, to remand this case based on evidence that was never presented to the ALJ would require Ms. Indorato to meet the standards set forth in the sixth sentence of 42 U.S.C. 405G. Ms. Indorato has never even asked until her reply brief, has never even asked for a sentence 6 remand. And Congress expected, when they wrote that sixth sentence of 405G, they expected a tough standard. They were concerned about courts remanding cases where a claimant hasn't really shown a good reason why they didn't give all of this evidence to the ALJ in the first place. And there's good reasons for that, given the administrative burdens under which this agency operates. I mean, ALJs decide hundreds of thousands of cases every year. I think 500,000 cases is the average. There's less than 2,000 ALJs in this agency. That's a lot of work to do. And if we remanded every case where the claimant came up after the hearing and said, here's some more evidence, because I didn't get a chance the first time around, but here I'm not satisfied with the result the first time around, really. So here's some more evidence. We can't remand all of those cases, and Congress doesn't want us to.
Let me ask you this. Your opponent's brief says that the vocational expert named Grzyk, I guess it is, testified that the restriction about twisting repetitive bending would drastically reduce the number of available jobs in the unskilled white category to 500 cashier positions, 500 mechanical assembler positions, and 200 hand packer positions. But you're maintaining that there are 15, 10,000 jobs available. What's the discrepancy?
I can clarify that. The ALJ asked a number of different hypothetical questions, which is often the case in these types of cases, because at the time of the hearing, the ALJ doesn't really know what he might eventually decide about the claimant's RFC. So the first hypothetical question envisioned a person who could perform light work, which means lifting up to 20 pounds. It might involve standing for up to 6 hours in an eight-hour day. And based on that hypothetical question, when restrictions were added in terms of bending and twisting and providing a sit-stand option, there were a far fewer number of the light jobs that the vocational expert identified. And that's where those 500 light jobs, and I don't recall exactly what the light jobs were because I'm just not that familiar with that part of the vocational expert's testimony. But the ALJ then asked another hypothetical question based on the ability to perform sedentary work. Sedentary work, you're sitting most of the time. Lifting is a maximum of 10 pounds with really more like occasional lifting of just small items. And then in that case, when the ALJ asked again about adding the restrictions of twisting, no repetitive bending, and allowing a sit-stand option so that the person can get up and move around a little bit to relieve their pain from the back impairment, that based on that hypothetical question was when the vocational expert identified the 10,000 jobs. It was 3,500 cashier jobs, 3,500 hand packager jobs, and 3,000 mechanical assembler jobs. I don't have the page numbers for that in my notes, but I'm fairly certain that is in the commissioner's brief.
We don't know if they're 10,000 or 1,000.
It was definitely 10,000 when you added them all up.
But what's so bizarre, it seems to me, is that if you're going to be a cashier, I mean, does it matter if you're a cashier at Carson's or you're a cashier at Walgreens or...
Well, the vocational expert, actually, there was some discussion about the cashier position, and the vocational expert explained that the type of cashier positions that he had in mind and the numbers that he was giving were for the lowest level of cashier position, the most simple type of cashier position, because, again, we remember the ALJ asked the vocational expert to consider jobs that were appropriate for someone or jobs that would require low levels of concentration. And that was based on...
Right, someone who couldn't see, had a headache, and whose back was hurting.
Well, I don't think the ALJ phrased it in exactly that way, but I would submit that that the RFC finding accounted for those problems.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Ahmed. Mr. Jackson, how much time is it? We can have a minute if you'd like.
Thank you very much. Just one quick comment here. There was a lot of discussion at the end about the vocational expert's testimony. I think if you closely read that testimony with the hypotheticals, and they are on pages 72 and 73 in the record, you'll see that what the vocational expert actually testified to is that given sedentary work with these restrictions that he was given by the ALJ, that there were 1,200 jobs, and yet somehow in his final decision, we're up to 10,000.
Well, what difference does it make?
What matters about all of that is that, you know, going back to what is not included in any of the residual functional capacity assessment is the blurred vision and the headaches.
Yes, but that you only brought that up afterwards.
No, Your Honor,
it played very little role in your original evidence. I do not understand the basis on which you tried to submit this evidence after the record was closed.
It was not in that evidence that was submitted later. We're going back to the record.
All you have in the original record is that she told these doctors she had headaches and blurred vision of undetermined severity. And that's all we know.
And it's throughout her testimony. And it's in the post-hearing memo
but
that was submitted by her attorney.
Severity.
But it's reasonably connected to the
It may be, of course, it has a cause. But that doesn't. But the fact that it has a cause does not determine what the severity is. And there's no evidence about the severity.
But she did testify that what it did cause her to do was it interrupted her daily activities. And that's the best testimony we have here of how it affected her.
Right, because you didn't have neurological testimony about the severity of her symptoms.
So we had her own credible
testimony. Right, her own, well, yes, her own.
And the ALJ did not reject that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.